ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. Today you'll hear about plans to expand a barramundi farm in Northern Australia, but not everyone is excited.
It kind of contradicts what we've been trying to do when you put a barramundi zone right next to a sanctuary zone, which are two opposite things, so it's not in line with us.
Also this afternoon, what is next for the town of Mount Isa now that its copper mine has closed after 70 years of operation?
Everyone is feeling really apprehensive because we've had the closure now. We've been talking about it for years, but what does it actually mean to our community?
And if you've ever wanted to own 28 properties spanning 4.4 million hectares, you're in luck! Paraway Pastoral is up for sale. I wonder if you can guess the price tag. All these stories and plenty more coming up on the Country Hour. Let's get into it. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. We're on the TV via Channel 25. And g'day if you've tuned in via the podcast. First up this afternoon,
to the mango bingo, we all gon' bongo for the mango bingo.
Yep, let's head to the Sydney markets, where ripe Kensington Pride mangoes from the Northern Territory have arrived this week. Yep, you heard correct. Mangoes in July. Red Rich Fruits have produced these early mangoes. I spoke earlier to the company's director, Matt Polisi.
We have, mate. It's a very early start to Australia's favourite fruit, the Kensington Pride mango, so we're all very excited.
What was the key to producing July mangoes?
Oh, look, there was some guy, so it's all about the tree health up there. There's been a few little farmers that are in pockets where they got the cold snap early. So they got their particular orchards flowered early, and then, you know, it's very spread across the region this year, as anyone from Darwin knows. The weather's been fairly tricky this last winter, so cold and then hot and then rainy. So it hasn't been easy for farmers.
What sort of volumes are going down at the moment?
Oh, look, we've only packed 3,500 so far. So you'll see through July, the next few weeks, you'll probably see 3,000 odd mango trays packed. So that's not very many.
Yep.
And then in August, that'll go to 20,000-30,000 trays. September, it'll start increase again with the bulk of the crop out of the Northern Territory sort of hitting the first week of October.
Right. So for mango fans listening to this and starting to get hungry for some new season mangoes, when will volumes, I guess, get to a point where everyone will start seeing them in their local supermarket?
Probably the first week of September to the middle of September.
Right.
Yeah, so they'll be, you know, the really keen people can get in and the early adopters and get a piece of summer. And then as you get, the peak of the value will be mid-October. I think you'll start to see really affordable, good quality mangoes that start to fly, you know, around that, you know, $2.50, $3 mark thereabouts.
What are the tray prices like for July KPs?
Look, it's slow selling because it's not like up there where it's 30 degrees every day. It's down here, it's 10 and 12 degrees. So, look, it's between $60 and $80.
Yeah.
On the really early season, but it's very slow selling.
Who normally grabs those mangoes?
Oh, look, independent shopkeepers. Yep. So you'll see them in greengrocers, yeah.
How are you feeling about the 2025 harvest?
Oh, look, it's very early to say. Look, we sell mangoes out of every region. So at this stage, Darwin's looking like it's a couple of weeks behind schedule. So it's a little bit late, but the crop volumes are good. So I tell everyone, mangoes can break your heart on the farm. So we're pessimistically optimistic.
Have you had a chance to taste one of these July KPs?
I have.
They look great. The blush, from the pictures I've seen, the blush on them is beautiful. They look good.
Yeah, they look, they eat good. It's just, you know, it's having it's having the need to want a tropical piece of fruit when you're in a parka and a beanie on the eastern seaboard, you know, while they're delicious. It's, you know, it's one of those things that you're not really craving. But again, look, there's lots of people out there that want them for smoothies or to have a little treat because, you know, fruit's a bit boring this time of year. Like it's citrus and apples. Pretty much. So to get a tropical mango out there, you know, even though they're expensive, it's a good little treat.
Well, just finally, I'm sure you don't mean it when you say apples are boring because apples can be fantastic. Your company owns the rights to the Cosmic Crisp Apple. Now, I've been on the lookout for it, Matt. I haven't seen it for sale yet in the Northern Territory. When can Territorians expect to see it?
No, so this is only our second commercial crop, and you're right, apples aren't boring. They are magnificent, especially the Cosmic Crisp. But, no, so look, we'll probably have them nationwide next year.
Right.
So to develop a new apple variety from when we order the tree to when we're full producing is about 7 years. So it's a very long process you've got to go through, and we'll probably be to full production by 2029. So you'll start to see them in the Northern Territory, I would say, next July.
Right. So it's just a matter of increasing that volume to a point where you can get them everywhere. Yeah. Gotcha.
Correct, yeah. So, look, last year we did about 30,000 trays. This year it's 50,000 trays, and then that'll move to 150,000 next year and then 300,000 the year after.
You happy with how it's all going?
Oh, look, the good thing about the Cosmic Crisp Apple, it is a great experience for the consumer. So there's lots of new varieties in every product now, and most of them are underwhelming. But the Cosmic Crisp will deliver. We've, you know, like all the fruit we grow, we put a lot of effort into making sure that the end product is fantastic. And last year we sold out in 3.5-4 weeks. And then this year it's going to be 8 weeks. The feedback's really good. The product's standing up and consumers are responding really well. So we're very, very excited about this apple. And we feel it's going to change the way customers perceive apples and their expectation of quality in the category.
Hey, thanks for talking apples and mangoes with us this afternoon. Really appreciate it, Matt.
No problems at all, buddy. Thank you.
That's Matt Palisi, who's the director of Red Rich Fruits. That company has been picking ripe Kensington Pride mangoes off farms in Darwin's rural area. Those mangoes have arrived at the Sydney markets this week.
Hello there. I'm Sam Theo from Red Rich Fruits in Sydney. And this time of the year, all we do is sell mangoes. Mangoes and more mangoes, and we love them. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
And it's not just Kensington Prides. At the Royal Darwin Show just the other day, Andrew Bourne from the NT Farmers Association, he told us that he's been on some farms, again, near Darwin, that are getting ready to pick R2E2 mangoes.
Yeah, yesterday we were very fortunate to be out on TMP Farm, just out the back of Berry Springs. Nelson, the general manager, took us for a tour around his farm. R2E2s, ain't full fruit on the trees, ready to be exported next week, which is exceptionally early.
Whoa.
The KPs are looking fantastic as well. We've already been picking green mangoes, so Cow Savoys and the Falans have already been picked, packed and sent. So the mangoes are looking fantastic. The flowering down in Catherine looks great as well. So, yeah, the mango orchards are looking fantastic for this season. Hopefully we've got a really good year ahead of us.
Yep, it's August tomorrow and things are starting to fire up in the mango orchards of the Top End. If you're listening to the Country Hour this afternoon and you'd love to get a bit of skin in the game, guess what? 4.4 million hectares of pastoral country has just gone on the market. Get your wallet out and I'll tell you more next.
The WA fishing village with a jetty to nowhere.
Oh man, it's ridiculous. You can't leave it as it is. Either remove it or fix it.
That's Landline Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
Paraway Pastoral is a famous company with a massive portfolio of stations stretching across 4.4 million hectares, including Rocklands Station in the Territory's Barkly Tablelands. And guess what? The whole thing is up for sale. Paraway is owned by a fund that's managed by Macquarie Asset Management. The Country Hour's been told the portfolio could sell for more than $2.5 billion. Emily Doak has more.
Paraway has 28 stations, many of them steeped in Australia's pastoral history, like Pudginook, Mungindal and the Bulls Run in the Riverina, Butterbone in western New South Wales, and the historic Newstead in the New England, the setting for the Tom Roberts painting Golden Fleece. There's also holdings in the Wimmera in Victoria, the Queensland Channel Country and near the Gulf of Carpentaria. Across its 4.4 million hectares, Paraway runs 250,000 cattle and 200,000 sheep. David Goodfellow has worked in corporate agriculture, fund management and financial services for decades, including for Macquarie in building up Paraway Pastoral Company from 2007. He left the business in 2011, but is still involved in agribusiness and says the sale is likely to attract a lot of interest.
That geographic diversity through different climatic regions just adds so much value. It's not just about the individual properties and how brilliant they are. It's really about how those different properties cooperate together, particularly in, you know, challenging times in our industry, so that the business can actually take advantage of those challenging times, not being compromised by them. It's really encouraging for some of the big wealth holders right now to get into what is a very iconic business in Australia and keep it together.
Given your background and expertise in the industry, would you imagine that it would be Australian investors that would be in a position to do that, or is it likely to be investors from overseas?
I think both categories will probably compete for the acquisition because it's very attractive to both the big wealthy families in Australia who have got access to capital to do things like this. But it's also super attractive to the big institutions who are really looking for very, very good agribusinesses to invest in, of course, which Paraway is one of them.
Is agriculture still a good bet for investment in terms of this kind of thing?
Absolutely. And that's ongoing as a trend for investments because particularly for overseas funds, who really need to focus on diversification in their big superannuation fund, for example, the returns from agriculture are not correlated directly to the returns from the shares industry or, you know, the bonds portfolio industry or other forms of commercial property. Agriculture has been well proven to be able to provide enormous diversification. But I think also we all recognise that the world is not making any more agricultural land, but the population is growing enormously, isn't it?
Even, you know, given the global headwinds that we've got in terms of tariffs, trade, what's going on in the US, Australian agriculture still seen as a good bet for investment?
It certainly is. Some of the challenges have been that Queensland has now put land tax on foreign-owned farming land, and I know that's upset a few institutions who are trying to support our industry. We don't want to see that roll into other states, but at the end of the day, that's not a deal breaker necessarily. It just needs to be factored into what people can afford to pay for investments, of course.
Paraway, of course, was established in 2007 and it's been built up to what it is today with those 28 stations and quite a large enterprise. Do you think that the decision by Macquarie Asset Management to put it on the market now indicates that potentially it's going to do better for its shareholders by selling rather than continuing the investment in agriculture?
Well, surely that's a question to raise with Macquarie directly. But when Paraway Pastoral was set up, it actually is a company that's owned by a trust, which the investors have put money into. Macquarie is one of those investors, but most of the investors are the big institutions that just wanted to have access to a high-performing Australian agribusiness. So it's the investors that have actually made that decision to wind up the business. But to your question, I can only imagine that some of the investors have decided that they've done so well out of this, now it's time to take their money and go and put it into something else, perhaps that Macquarie Bank is working on, that's going to make them a lot more money elsewhere.
That's David Goodfellow, who works in ag and fund management. He was speaking there to Emily Doak about Paraway Pastoral. The for sale sign is up. How many dollars have you got, producer Fiona? I'm worried I might be $2.499999 billion short. It'd be good. It's a lot of famous stations associated in that portfolio. It's 16 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, I'm going to take you to Mount Isa. This week, you might have heard the news, the town's underground copper mine has officially ceased operation after 70 years. What's next for this iconic outback town? We'll talk about it after a little bit of Jerry Reed. Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. One of Australia's longest operating mines has this week come to an end. The underground copper mine at Mount Isa, which is owned by Glencore, it has closed and about 500 direct jobs have been lost. As Abby Holter reports, while the town marks that last shift, it's now looking down the road at an uncertain future.
For 70 years, the outback city of Mount Isa in Queensland has rumbled above ground, while its trademark copper mine blasted rock from ore below. And this week, the unofficial alarm clock at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. every day rang out for the final time.
Firing shot.
For residents like Janelle Robertson, you always remember your first blast. Or when someone else experienced theirs.
I remember back several years ago, I was at the Irish Club bottle shop and there was a backpacker couple standing at the counter. It was pretty obvious that they were travelling. And the blast went off and it was a huge one. And all the bottles were shaking on the walls, clinking together. And they both ducked under the counter and put their hands over their heads because they must have thought it was an earthquake. Anyway, we were all kind of... had a bit of a giggle, we're trying not to, and then we had to try and explain to them that it was just the mines and that they were okay.
It's the last hurrah for one of Australia's longest operating mines, the Mount Isa Copper Mine, settled in the red northwest Queensland dirt, one of the richest mining regions in the world. The 1.9-kilometre deep copper mine was Australia's deepest underground copper mine, as well as the country's third largest producer of copper. If you joined the over 900 kilometres of underground tunnels together, you could drive through them from Mount Isa to Townsville.
When you come to Mount Isa, you usually only come for a couple of years, or I came in a construction sort of sense, and then I got a job in the mines and I was only prepared to sort of stay for a couple of years. But the place grows on you so much, and it's just part of the part and parcel of the town. It's the firing 8 o'clock each morning and night. It was, know what time it is.
Rob Addington worked at the mine for 20 years and was one of the 500 workers who was made redundant.
I elected to do the redundancy. So how old I am, it's sort of probably a good time for me. Yeah, that was a bit of a shock. The worst part about that, and I don't want to bag the company, but we heard it through the media first. So everybody's going, wow. And they were very apologetic, but yeah, it's all of a sudden, okay, now we've got a deadline. You sort of sat back and go, okay, so what's going to happen now? So then the rumours start, and that's been going for the last 18 months or so. And when it comes to the final shift, yeah, there's a bit of sadness there. All of a sudden, it's real. Some have moved on, are going to move away. Some are moving out to other mines. You're going to miss those people, you know.
The mine began operations in 1924, but for its first 30 years was predominantly a lead-zinc-silver mine. Historian Barry Merrick explains it wasn't until 1943, during World War II, that the mine temporarily shifted its focus to copper to help with the war effort. Then in 1953, global demand for copper surged.
And from then on, it was just boom time after boom time. Basically, from 1953 up until the late 70s, there was always expansion work and expansion work, and there was accommodation in town was just next possible to get, and an influx of people everywhere, so, yeah.
Mr. Merrick says that although the closure is significant, the mine running out of high-grade copper ore was inevitable.
It's a hell of a lot of mine. It's a lot of rock. It just doesn't keep growing. It's, you know, if you take it out, nothing can replace it.
City Mayor Peter McRae looks out towards the Mount Isa mine from her office window each day.
I think it's going to affect our psyche for a while, because it's been, and everyone has grown up with hearing those blasts. And to know that that mine is not over there operating, I guess it's so embedded in our community and part of our history. So it's going to take a little while to readjust.
She believes the rippling effects of losing the lifeblood of the town will be felt for a long time.
Everyone is feeling really apprehensive because we've had the closure now. We've been talking about it for years, but what does it actually mean to our community? You know, we hear people are slowly moving away, and it saddens us when we know that potentially there's still so much opportunity left here and we've got such an amazing community.
For former mine worker Rob Addington, clocking off on his last shift was an emotional day, but he's hopeful for the Outback City's future.
Look, yeah, you do get a little bit of a lump in your throat. This community, it's a community. And you get involved in the town itself. It's some great people here. It's sort of funny. I'm still waiting to see what happens. And I think that's the thing. We'll just sort of wait to see what happens. I think it'll be just a transition period and they'll kick off with something else over there. But the underground thing is no more.
That's now former Mount Isa mine worker Rob Addington speaking to Abby Holter. No more blasts at 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. in the Isa. I wonder if you've ever been in Mount Isa and felt that for yourself. Our text number at the Country Hour, 0487 99 1057.
Get set for spring with ABC Organic Gardener. There's tips for veggie success, attracting more butterflies, growing oats and more. Organic Gardener Magazine, available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
Now, yesterday I shared with you a moment from Parliament House where the member for Johnston, Justine Davis, asked an interesting question, and in many ways she made a pretty serious allegation about the air quality monitor gauge that's at Palmerston. Have a listen to a bit of that question.
Is it being disabled to hide the pollution levels people there are being exposed to? More importantly, how can the community trust they're being told the truth about the air they're breathing? What steps is the government taking to ensure people can access accurate, real-time data? And what options do residents have to independently verify pollution levels in their area? Thank you.
So that was the question put to the Territory's Minister for Environment, Joshua Burgoyne, who initially did not have an answer, but he returned to question time yesterday afternoon with an answer, and it's a pretty simple one. The monitor out there at Palmerston, it was out of action for a few days because of maintenance. Here's the Minister's response, which includes a crack at the member for Johnston for asking that question in the first place.
To imply to the public that the independent NT Environment Protection Authority are deliberately trying to hide or lie to them is a serious allegation. The member for Johnston has suggested that the NTEPA have switched off the Palmerston Ambient Air Quality Monitor in an attempt to hide pollution levels. Madam Speaker, the National Association of Testing Authorities, referred to as NATA, standards refers to the international standards that are used to ensure technical compliance and reliability. In accordance with those standards, contractors conduct routine monthly maintenance and calibration procedures at all air quality stations in the Northern Territory. I've been advised, Madam Speaker, that maintenance and calibration works were carried out from the 21st of July to the 24th of July 2025, prior to the dates the member for Johnston accused the NTPA of switching off the monitors, and it is only during this period that a brief interruption of data may have occurred. However, I have sought information from the department and from the experts, Madam Speaker, have assured me that all data remains within the required standards. Madam Speaker, it is so important, I think, when we're in this house to ensure that whenever we're making these accusations that we are able to back these up. If we want to ensure that we're doing politics differently in the future, if the member for Johnston would like to ask me these types of questions before making those public accusations, I'd be more than happy to undertake and seek the answers she requires. Thank you very much, Madam Speaker.
That is the NT's Environment Minister Joshua Burgoyne in Parliament yesterday. We are 3 minutes away from the 1 o'clock news here on the ABC. You might remember earlier in the week I told you about a push for a Senate inquiry into allowing more beef imports from the US, Canada and Mexico. The Nationals were driving this. They're not happy. And this is what we heard earlier from Nationals leader David Littleproud.
Well, we're looking to get a Senate inquiry up. We're trying to get the Greens to support it. And I think it's the sensible way forward, considering the evidence that continues to mount, that this looks to be a decision predicated on time and on getting Anthony Albanese a meeting with President Trump without looking at the proper scientific reasons nor processes, not only in the decision-making, but in terms of giving us comfort around the traceability of livestock that may have originated in Mexico or in South America or Canada coming to this country through the United States. And in fact, making sure there's good governance around that decision.
That's the Nat's David Littleproud. He's pushing for a Senate inquiry into these beef imports. Now, this has just been voted on in Canberra. What happened? I'll tell you next.
G'day, it's Jeff Tucker from the Sydney Fish Market, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
I'm joined in the studio by Fiona Broome. Fiona, federal senators have just voted on this motion for a Senate inquiry into the beef imports. Yay or nay? Is it happening?
The noes had it on this occasion, Matt. Right. It came down to a pretty narrow margin, 33 votes to 27. Now, the Coalition has 27 seats in the Senate. They were hoping that they would get the backing of the Greens' 10 senators to get this motion over the line. They haven't succeeded on this occasion. So the Coalition, as we've heard, they were wanting those import changes to be referred to the Rural and Regional Affairs Committee for an inquiry, off the back of claims that there was evidence that the biosecurity director of biosecurity had recommended an independent review. We haven't heard anything from the Greens Party, as far as I know, nor the Agriculture Minister Julie Collins. Nationals leader David Littleproud is currently speaking with media at Parliament House, though, about that result today.
Okay. The noes have it, 33 to 27. There will not be a Senate inquiry into those beef imports. I'll see you back here in 5 minutes, folks, for a chat with the Weather Bureau. As always, if you've got a question you want to put to the Bureau, send it through on that text line 0487 99 1057. Let's go to the newsroom.
My name is Tu from Tu's Garden. My farm is in Acacia Hills, and we are gearing up for the fabulous mango seasons, and you listen to Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. If you missed the start of today's Country Hour, then you missed the news that ripe, juicy Kensington Pride mangoes have been picked, packed and sent to the Sydney markets this week. And they're fetching up to $80 a tray. Thank you very much. In a moment on the Country Hour, let's talk about hairy African lovegrass. It's been popping up in parts of Central Australia. What is it, and should we be worried? And in a moment, you will hear about plans to expand a barramundi farm in northern Australia, but not everyone's excited about it.
It kind of contradicts what we've been trying to do when you put a barramundi zone right next to a sanctuary zone, which are two opposite things. So it's not in line with us.
So we've got lots to talk about between now and 1:30. Hope you can stick around. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Ruby Cuthbertson is there this afternoon. How are you, Ruby?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm not too bad. Here we are on the last day of July, and they've had 6 millimetres at Elsie Homestead near Mataranka.
Indeed. Yeah, getting a little bit of rain. A few showers just ahead of a southeasterly surge that's coming through tomorrow.
Is there more rain on the way, Ruby?
For the top end, could see, just a few showers around tonight and tomorrow morning ahead of the dry southeasterlies that come through early tomorrow and on Saturday as well. Light showers, if anything, in the top end. Could see a little bit around Darwin. In the south, the Barkly the cloud band that's just going over Tennant Creek at the moment. There's been a report from south of the fire ground near Tennant Creek that there's been a few showers there, just light showers. Tennant Creek's picked up 0.2 millimetres of rain today. And, yeah, we're seeing a little bit on the radar, but nothing too significant.
That is good goss from the fire ground there, Ruby. I've just brought up the NAFI website. So this is a quite a sizable fire that they've been battling for a few days, and things are looking promising in that there's only a few hot spots on the northern end of that fire, and it still hasn't jumped the Barkly Highway from what I can tell. So yeah, that is good, and if they can get a bit more moisture, that'll be perfect. In terms of millimetres, what is possible across the Barkly in the next 24, 48 hours?
So in terms of rainfall, it's most likely going to be this afternoon, easing into the evening. If anything, a couple more millimetres could see isolated 5 to 10 millimetres, but more likely a light shower or two there. And then, winds picking up tomorrow morning. Going to see, at the moment, we're seeing around 20 to 30 kilometre per hour winds with max gusts of about 40, but tomorrow that'll pick up to about 30 to 40 kilometres per hour, possibly gusting to 60 in the morning, and going to stay elevated throughout the weekend, easing on Monday. So,
You wouldn't want to be fighting a fire with 60k gusts.
No, you wouldn't. So, it's important to just stay alert of that and keep up to date with any warnings that go out.
Okay, I've got a text here from Roger saying, Matt, can you please ask the Bureau if there is a likelihood of a good dry season type weather for the month of August?
So in terms of temperatures, it looks to be the max temperature is slightly warmer than average throughout the top end, and then the minimum temperatures warmer than average throughout the whole territory. Rainfall-wise, pretty much bang on average in the top end, slightly wetter throughout the south of the territory.
Okay. Humidity, just having a holiday in August? It's welcome to do
hopefully.
So.
We'll see, yeah. I'm not too sure about the humidity, but probably just what we usually expect in the top end. So a few dry days and then more humid days when we don't have those ridges poking through.
Okay, anything else we need to be aware of this afternoon?
I would just note that if you're in the top end, it's going to get drier from most significantly from Saturday, and also a bit windier. So Saturday morning, windy across the whole top end, including Darwin, and then Sunday morning, more so in the south of the top end, gusting 40, 50 possible, and coastal wind warnings are likely Friday through Sunday. Just keep up to date with that on the website.
Wonderful. Ruby, thanks for your time this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt.
And just going back to the NAFI website this afternoon. So this is the Northern Australia Fire Information Service. It's a free website. You can check it out this afternoon for yourself. And you can see those southeasterly winds causing a few problems for some cattle stations. It would appear there's a fire getting away on Cattle Creek Station in that southern Tenami, northern Tenami area. That's starting to burn a bit of country. And it looks like the good folks out at Waterloo and Rosewood Station are dealing with a pretty nasty blaze as well.
How you going? It's Brian. I'm the local tow truck driver out at Daly Waters and the fixer of broken things out here. And welcome everyone to the Country Hour.
0487991057 is the text number here at the Country Hour. Angus says, Matt, Parliament had their chance on these US meat imports. They were a bit short on numbers. The unions can now step in and refuse to unload that meat, saying we don't believe it's safe. reckons Angus. And Roger hoping for a good August. I don't know, Roger, what did you make of that forecast? It's always a bit tough, isn't it? It's always a bit tough. Hairy African lovegrass. Have you heard of it? Maybe you've seen it on your property. Now, this is not to be confused with other African lovegrasses that you find in the southern states. No, no, no. Hairy African lovegrass is a bit different, and it has started to pop up in spots around Central Australia. It hasn't been declared a weed as of yet, but it is invasive, and people are starting to get concerned. Charles Geary caught up with Amber Clark from the NT Weed Management Branch to learn more about it.
So what we are calling, what we tend to call African lovegrass is actually hairy lovegrass. So it's Aerogrostis trichophora. It is commonly mistaken from the African lovegrass, which is the Aerogrostis curvula, which is the problem Aerogrostis sort of down south. But it's not really, that particular species is not really recorded in Central Australia. So we... The herbarium has made it clear we should start calling it hairy lovegrass. So I'm going to try and do that for the rest of this interview, but we'll try not to forget and slip back into the African lovegrass. It's not currently a declared weed in the Northern Territory. Invasive, there's a number of about six different species in that, say, Aerogrostis genus that are introduced, and they are listed as a species of concern under the Alice Springs Regional Weed Management Strategy. Yeah, but not currently a declared weed in the Northern Territory under the Weeds Management Act.
And where are we currently seeing a hairy African lovegrass pop up here in the Northern Territory?
It's at the moment, it's mostly restricted to roadsides and often sort of disturbed areas. So people are tending to see it coexist with buffalo grass a fair bit, or perhaps, you know, maybe taking over areas where buffalo grass might have been originally.
And that's primarily here in Central Australia?
Yeah, my understanding is that it's the hairy lovegrass is the sort of Central Australia, the arid version of the African lovegrass that's a weed further down south where there's a bit more rainfall.
You mentioned its relationship with buffalo grass. Buffalo grass is an important source of feed for NT pastoralists, but is also a declared weed. Does it coexist with buffalo grass, or have you heard of reports of African lovegrass outcompeting buffalo grass?
Yeah, I think we're still getting a lot of information. It is a new invasive species, so, you know, the situation is evolving and we still are receiving more information. But we have had reports from pastoralists that it is starting to invade areas or outcompete areas that did have buffalo in it. I understand that it is also potentially happy in saline or subsaline soil, so it can go into areas that buffalo grass doesn't usually do very well in.
For pastoralists, what sort of impacts does that have on their ability to operate as a pastoral industry and on their cattle?
I understand that the species, the hairy lovegrass, isn't very palatable, and it's a really last resort species for cattle. So, I can understand it is an emerging concern for some pastoralists in the area.
You've mentioned that it's a bit of an emerging issue here, and it has been declared a weed in some other jurisdictions. Why hasn't it been declared a weed here in the Northern Territory?
I guess it's, as we say, it's an emerging issue. So it's something that the Weeds Branch are looking into. We are going to be updating the Alice Springs Regional Weed Strategies next year. And as part of that process, we will be assessing new and emerging weeds to Central Australia. So it will definitely be considered as part of that strategy review.
What does it mean for a plant when it is declared a weed, and what would be the process for declaring it a weed?
The process would be around, there'd be a technical risk assessment done by our technical risk assessment committee, and then it's a matter of collecting all the information and presenting that information to the minister to make a decision about whether it meets the criteria for a declared weed in the Northern Territory. Once a species is declared, it creates a number of obligations under the Weeds Management Act around people requiring not being allowed to spread on their property, not, you know, you need, you're not able to sell it or use it, those kind of things, yeah.
One of the things that have been mentioned by some people about African lovegrass are the difficulties in identifying it and some of its similarities to other grasses. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is a hard one. They're in that, within that genus, there are another six introduced species in that Aerogrostis genus and 25 sort of native species, including sort of the native woolly bark grass. So they do have a lot of similarities, so it can be quite difficult to identify.
And are any efforts currently being made to tackle hairy African lovegrass here in Central Australia?
I know that there's a number of land care groups that are working across Alice Springs, and they would be tackling this species as part of the, you know, a range of weed management that they undertake. Our team has a program to look at bufflegrass specifically, and we are encouraging people to try and co-treat them. So really be aware of hairy lovegrass when you're doing buffle control. And, you know, they respond to similar sort of chemicals and similar rates, so similar treatments. Because we don't want people to, you know, manage buffle and then that become a vacuum for hairy lovegrass. So we're really trying to, in the communication materials and when we're talking with landholders and land managers, we're trying to encourage them to tackle both or consider both at the same time. There may be more action in the future as part of when the weed management branch, in conjunction with our stakeholders, review the Alice Springs regional weed strategies, that might kind of prompt some more action or it becoming more of a priority in the area.
That is Amber Clark from the NT's Weed Management Branch speaking to Charles Geary about hairy African lovegrass. On the text line this afternoon, someone here says, typical weeds branch, talking it down. The weeds branch were alerted to the danger of this by botanists at least 10 years ago and they've done nothing, says someone here this afternoon. 0487 99 1057. Is this hairy African lovegrass popping up in your part of the territory? Should it be declared a weed? You can join the conversation on the Country Hour, 0487 99 1057. Up next, I'll tell you about plans, big plans, to expand a barramundi farm, but not everyone's a fan of it. Across the territory on the ABC, this is the Country Hour. Traditional owners in WA's Kimberley region are concerned over Tassal's plans to expand its barramundi farming operation near Derby. Now, Tassal's best known for farming salmon in Tasmania, but it also runs the Cone Bay Barra Farm in the Kimberley and is looking to increase production. Dem Bim Gari, board member and Marine Park chair Francis Woolagudja, says looking after that local marine environment needs to be prioritised.
Initially, when it first came to us, expansion was always a concern just because we've adopted the whole barramundi concept in the past, and Barramundi Asia came in, which took over from the last operators, and now Tassal's come in and wanted to expand, which is obviously not in line with traditional owners and the way we've conducted ourselves with conservation and marine parks, everything for the last X amount of years around creating a marine park around protecting country. So we've obviously got concerns when we first heard it, and so we kind of want to be a part of obviously the monitoring of it and how to deal with the impacts. Obviously, expansion is always going to be more impacts on country.
If this goes ahead and this is allowed, is that concerning about what could be allowed even further into the future?
Yeah, so the way we look at it, obviously, if it does go ahead, we would have to up our role in obviously monitoring and protection, just because we feel like some of the areas that we've seen the maps of, the new zones, we feel like they're really close to some sanctuary zone we've created with the marine park. So it kind of contradicts what we've been trying to do when you put a a barramundi zone right next to a sanctuary zone, which are two opposite things. So it doesn't, it's not in line with us. So at the same time, we're trying to, well, being prepared for the future impact. So obviously with expansion, the traditional owners will have to expand their, obviously, role in protection. We've done a lot of time and effort into creating the marine park, and the idea was first and foremost conservation. So that's really who we are at the core as traditional owners. We're a conservationist first, and we understand that there's, you know, there's government that want to, for the region around jobs and industry. So we get all that. I guess our role first and foremost is just how do we protect and manage and monitor.
Are you optimistic that your voice will be listened to?
Oh, well, look, we think that the government would really listen to us as traditional owners, as in Dam Mangari. Obviously, we've got the biggest marine park in the state, which partners up with the state. So it kind of reflects a little bit on the government saying at the same time, well, you've told the public and traditional owners that you want to do marine park around protection. So at the same time, you've kind of got to stick to that narrative around conservation and bringing in, obviously, something huge around barramundi, which will really impact country. That's opposite to what you've been doing with us for the last 15 years around spending time and effort around marine parks. So we think that the government wouldn't contradict everything they've done for the last 15 years, and we think we will try find a middle ground. We're not saying, traditional owners are not saying that we're against industry. We just want to make sure that it doesn't impact country and, you know, overpower traditional owners and what we're doing on country.
What would the ideal outcome be for you in relation to this expanded proposal?
Like I said earlier, look, we're not against industry. We feel like, you know, if industry and obviously conservation can find a middle spot, we're just mindful of the expansion being something so big. And we've been promoting tourism for the last 20 years around protecting country. So for us, it's just kind of, you know, answer the question around where does barramundi industry fit within conservation and looking after country. So trying to make sure that that's our priority is the conservation, and then also having a place for industry in our country, which we're not against.
That is Francis Woolagoodja speaking to Ruby Littler in the Kimberley. In a statement provided to the ABC, TASL says the company's Ocean Barramundi project is an exciting opportunity for the region, contributing to local job growth and investment in local suppliers. It says the footprint of the project removes about 400 hectares from the proposal that was previously submitted by the previous owners, recognising concerns that were raised by important local stakeholders, such as traditional owners and recreational fishers. It says we're proud and humbled to have secured the consent for the project via a voluntary Indigenous land use agreement with the Mayala traditional owners, on whose country the proposal is wholly located. That's the statement from TASL. On the topic of seafood, if you missed the Country Hour yesterday, then you missed our conversation about Northern Territory mud crabs getting flown to Macau. Exports to Macau are back. The Country Hour understands we haven't sent crabs to that part of the world in about 25 years. But it's happening again. If you missed that interview, it's up on our website this afternoon if you search for NT Country Hour. And we'll talk seafood tomorrow because August 1 is the start of the tiger prawn season in Northern Australia. How are things shaping up for our prawn fishers? You'll find out on tomorrow's program. Just quickly on the text, someone here says, give the weeds branch a break. I'd hate to work in that office. It's got no windows. You can't even see the gamba grass growing next door. Have a lovely afternoon and keep it rural.